So Bruce Ross, he was talking about it in a different way, but he was saying the same stuff. So I'm very excited to hear what you have to say tonight, Bruce Ross. This mic is all yours.
Alrighty, thanks, Lynn. And I found this to be a really helpful topic in studying and applying A Course in Miracles. And it's really only mentioned one place that I know of in the fifth paragraph of Lesson 136, which is the one about sickness as a defense against the truth. And I've found this to be really helpful, just as a metaphor for looking at how we have basically made up a lie, and that keeps us mindless and dreaming, and we can use that exact same technology of the mind, if you will, to undo it. We just turn the tables on the tiny mad idea, and it gets turned around. So just to back up a little bit, this double shield of oblivion is something that Ken Wapnick has referred to in a number of his different audios, and I just find it really helpful, because what it essentially involves is the idea that let me just read the quote from the lesson, the paragraph that it comes from, which is Lesson 136 in the workbook of A Course in Miracles, and it's paragraph 5, and it's actually the second sentence that it is explicitly mentioned. And the first part of this lesson basically talks about what most people usually think of in terms of the idea of sickness being about form, but it really is obviously all about the mind. And then as it gets down to this section in the paragraph 5, it reinforces that by talking about the actual technique that we use, and sort of the splits that we all collectively went through. And it says, it is this quick forgetting of the part you play in making your, quote, reality that makes defenses seem to be beyond your own control. But what you have forgot can be remembered, given willingness to reconsider the decision, which is doubly shielded by oblivion. So basically, we're saying to ourselves, we made up a massive dream, but we can use that dream as our way out of the dream. And synchronistically, and very, very appropriately today, I attended remotely an online study group that meets quarterly in Denver at the Rocky Mountain Miracle Center regarding the Lighthouse newsletter that was published for a number of years by the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. And the one that we talked about today, just synchronistically, I hadn't planned this, but it just worked out beautifully, talked about the world is the royal road to heaven. And essentially the idea being that we use every little bit of our experience in the world as a forgiveness classroom rather than another brick, brick by brick in the prison. We brick by brick essentially unbuild ego's prison and make it a classroom that's open and full of light and fresh air, so metaphorically, so to speak, by disassembling ego's prison. So let me finish the paragraph. It says, you're not remembering is but the sign that this decision still remains in force as far as your desires are concerned. Mistake not this for fact. Defenses must make unrecognizable. They aim at doing this, and it is this they do. So the defenses, then, that we're talking about here is these two shields that defend us from being mindful and specifically from looking at the part of the mind that where we think is a terrorizing place to look at, which is the home of evil, darkness, sin, guilt, and fear, death, that whole paradigm that surrounds the idea that separation was possible. So in the process of looking at that, we reveal to ourselves that there's nothing there. But we don't look at it until we get past the first shield of oblivion, which is really all the stuff in the world that we made to keep us mesmerized, spellbound, seduced, and completely entranced and firefighting mode with all the stuff in the world that involves. That's why I kind of like to tie it in with an acronym I find helpful, which is GIST, G-I-S-T. And the G in the GIST acronym is the guilt, which is really is a kind of a placeholder word for the granddaddy idea of the ego, which is that, you know, somehow we managed to destroy perfect oneness. We actually believe we pulled it off, maybe not consciously, but on some unconscious level, we play out over and over again the martyrdom, the victimhood, the self-abuse, the whether or not we do it at our own hands or seemingly through the hands of someone else, that whole victimhood scenario is essentially the result of an unconscious belief that we need to be punished, which sounds ridiculous, but when you put it in those terms, but if we still have experiences that upset us and we choose to be upset by things, that's essentially what we're, the hymn book, so to speak, that we're still singing out of. So in order to look at that, we need to just see, where am I still tying into that thought system? Where am I, you know, subscribing to that bulletin that provides the knee-jerk reaction that triggers those thoughts and feelings? So, and then the other three letters of the GIST acronym is individuality, space, and time. And I think that kind of ties into the outer shield of oblivion very nicely, that we have in the outer shield anything that has to do with special interest, anything that has to do with, you know, the we-they paradigm, not making it about the other person, but making it all about me. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, we would have to admit that a good portion, we can each fill in the percentage on a daily basis, but it's always embarrassingly high, I think, for most of us, if we're really honest, that as we go about our day and looking at the things that we do for, you know, yours truly rather than for the benefit of everyone, it's a pretty large number, you know, in terms of a percentage of the time that we spend dealing with, you know, the what's in it for me idea. And to not beat ourselves up when we catch ourselves in that mode and realize that that's what we came here as a default programming. That's how we set it up. And that's why the course admonishes us gently to try to see things as they are, not the way we've set them up, because the way we've set them up is to see ourselves at the mercy of the world and everything in it. And that's, yeah, pretty pathetic. It's pretty miserable. So the outer shield again is anything to the individuality or space or time. So the whole idea of personhood, and that doesn't require a body even. I mean, we can have a personality that is, you know, attached to our stories of our life here in 3D land. And we can even think of a soul that transcends, you know, goes, you know, survives lifetimes of bodies and personas but still is separate from everything. And so that individuality is the one thing that really is at the heart of the guilt, but is also the manifestation in terms of the form, you know, whether it's a body or a persona that is appendage to that. So if we can kind of look at our investment in individuality and that identity, valuation, and see how much trouble that gets us into, and just kind of gently laugh at it and realize, my gosh, you know, if I'm really paying attention and not trying to cover it up, there's a whole lot of grief associated with just trying to maintain this separate self, this seemingly separate self, and seemingly is such a good word. In the study group this afternoon on the Lighthouse that took place in Denver at the Rocky Mountain Miracle Center, Chris Dixon, who's the moderator, did a wonderful job reminding everyone that it really is, you know, it's all about the mind, and you know, we can afford to you know, look at gently the way in which we want to reinforce that identity of separate self. But the important word that, as she pointed out, is that that happens throughout so much of the course, and also in Ken Wapnick's writings that I'm going to read a little bit from, is the word seeming, because the seeming is a reminder that it's an appearance. It's just an appearance of a reality. Now, granted, it's a very convincing one. As Richard Bach said in the book Illusions, Don Shimoda was talking to Richard in that story. If you happen to have read that, how everything's here is, if it involves space or time, is illusion. We're living in MGM worlds, Warner Brothers lifetimes, and those realities, so-called, are seeming realities. Obviously, we have to deal with them on the level that we believe we're at, and it'd be silly not to. But at the same time, if we can begin to cultivate an awareness that suggests that it's massively, massively, should I say it again? Massively, deceiving, but incredibly convincing hologram that we've imbued and invested and endowed with special effects galore. I mean, we can zoom into the molecules in the bodies that make up this hologram that we identify with as being separate and distinct from the rest of the universe, and we can say it's got organs and tissues and cells. And a few weeks ago, Lynn and I were talking about she pointed out a video that shows us some really cool animations of the processes within a cell, of which we have trillions or quadrillions or however many cells we have in our bodies. It's just a lot. And so it's a very convincing thing. You zoom in and you keep going and you see all these the DNA and the ribosomes and all the nucleic goodies and pieces added until you finally get to the atoms and molecules, atoms, quarks, and beyond, and which then reminds us that it's mostly empty space. And if we zoom back out, all the way back out to the scale of, in space anyway, of our bodies, which we think are so solid, we zoom out the other direction, out past solar systems and galaxies, and realize that that's mostly empty space too. So there's a whole lot of nothing going on. With apologies to Jerry Lee Lewis. Were you going to say something, Glenn? Do you have your microphone on?
Oh, no, I have my microphone muted. I'm just listening and agreeing completely. It is all these things that we're thinking we are, we don't even know. We have no idea. We're attributing ourselves to this physical body that we don't, it isn't even one thing. It's billions of living things all living together. And inside of them are living things. So
exactly.
We know what it is. It's just incredibly silly. I'm going to mute my mic and let you continue. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Well, thanks. Thanks for that addition. Yeah. And that's a good reminder. The fractality, the idea that each of these seemingly infinitesimal parts is made up of collections, and those are collected into larger collections. And, we can keep looking at the fractality or the holographic quality of all these seemingly separate parts, and going as small or as large a scale as we want through the seeming scale that we think we're at, all the way up to the macrocosm and down to the microcosm, and back and forth. But it's all that stuff that seems to occupy space and travel through at least one dimension of time that we know of, although physicists tell us that tachyons are particles that have three temporal dimensions and one spatial dimension, where we have the opposite. That's kind of a little amusing aside. So we make up all these bizarre and inexplicable things that have all these properties that we can define and describe and differentiate, and all this stuff to just keep our minds so busy and preoccupied. And And yet, at the end of the day, when we stop and think about, you know, how complicated we make things, it just becomes an interesting exercise to look at what's the purpose? You know, why did we do all this? And that's what gets back to, you know, the idea that we can use this acronym of GIST, or guilt, individuality, space, and time, as little trigger categories for recognizing that if any of those are involved, we're pretty likely treading on ego's turf in our mind. If we feel guilty about something, if there's the least bit of upset, discomfort, pick your favorite unpleasant emotion or feeling of dis-ease or a lack of ease or malaise or just being out of sorts, you know, whether it's angry or depressed or whatever. Oh, there was a quote that someone shared at that study group that I posted on Facebook because I thought it was really good. Let me see if I can find it real quick here. It kind of ties into that. Okay, let's see. It is here and then here and then here. A few clicks away, I think I can get to it. Okay. It's basically this quote here that says, whatever is lacking is what I'm not giving. So the idea of that is we think that our spatial temporal bodies, you know, first of all, we think that as one of the workbook lessons says, we think we're the home of evil, darkness, and sin. That's that whole realm of the mind that ego really does not want us to look at. So we made up a world of lack, so that by default, everything that we do is geared toward trying to resolve a lack of some kind or another, whether it's breathing, you know, lack of oxygen, food and drink, sex, money, drugs, rock and roll. Use all the cliches there. You know, cars, houses, personal possessions, you know, all the myriad of things that we think we need on a physical level. You know, now that we have, you know, all these special diets and nutritional, you know, variations of what we think works for us, we have all these, you know, very complicated nutritional regimens and you know, health practices and then on the level of the mind, you know, we, as Ken Wapnick points out in a number of his talks, you know, we also have an incredibly sensitive emotional system that can react with just basically, you know, upset for the least little bit of insult to our egos. If we think we're being excluded or victimized, or, you know, like it says, you know, beware the temptation to see yourself unfairly treated, because we've built an incredibly elaborate system to make sure that throughout the day, if we follow the default mode of the ego programming, that's, you know, what we get triggered by. But the beauty of it and the whole point of this idea of the double shield of oblivion and also this Lighthouse article that we read from today, which I can post the link. Maybe if I post it in the chat, maybe Lynn can post it on the room. Let me see if I can find it real quick here. It's here it is. The world is a royal road to heaven, which is a really good article. Let me just post that in the chat window in case. And I'll post it in the post that I make of this recording too later on. But the idea then is that we can use every little bit of the space and the time identification and our individuality and everything that's associated with the stuff that we think we need to do in order to survive and thrive in the world as our classroom. We can use all that stuff. In fact, in a sense, we must ultimately turn it all over to the Holy Spirit for deinterpretation or reinterpretation or however we want to look at it. Because left to our own devices, we're probably going to, you know, misinterpret a few things. So the other quote that I thought was real interesting was when Ken was referring to, you know, the really pathetic range of options that our egos believe that we have. it's, you know, in this Lighthouse article, he says, anger and sickness are the only two alternatives open to us, as egos anyway. Do I attack you or do I let something or someone else attack me? So obviously the sickness being the defense against the truth, which lesson 136 ties into beautifully, is really that whole attack system. That's basically, you know, we can be sick from something outside of ourselves, or we can, you know, be consciously aware that any projection is just an external manifestation of an inward thought, since ideas don't leave their source. And, you know, when we appear to be at the hands of, you know, at the mercy of someone else's hands, or whether we, you know, are aware more consciously sometimes of doing that to ourselves, it doesn't matter, because we, in either case, we're basically playing into the ego's script of thinking that we've done something wrong, and we done blew it, and therefore we need to, you know, self-medicate, self-punish, self-abuse, self, you know, destruct, and any less than happy behavior, whether it's acted out physically or just in the mind, will do, because that maintains the belief in separation. So I'm going to read a little bit of that Lighthouse article, because I think it just really fits so nicely. And let me see if I can find that paragraph where it talks about the doubly shielded stuff. I'm going to search real quick and find it. Here it is. So just to kind of give a quick overview of this, this is Volume 7, Number 2, June 1996 of the Lighthouse articles, which you can get, by the way. There's a new bound book that you can get from the Foundation from A Course in Miracles that has all the Lighthouse articles and some of the things that were never online. I haven't got it yet, but it's on my list of books to get and read. And anyway, these Lighthouse articles are just wonderful. So he starts out by talking about, you know, how the gift we owe to Freud for talking about the dreams as the royal road to the mind and to the unconscious in particular. And then the point that Ken makes here beautifully is that our waking dreams and our sleeping, our, you know, diurnal and nocturnal dreams are the same. You know, in the text somewhere, I believe it says, you know, that they differ in form only, and that's all, but the content's the same. The content is separation happened, and as zombies of that belief, unless we look at it gently with our inner kindness teacher, we will continue to act out the script that suggests that, you know, we you know, like the myth of Sisyphus that was brought up today, you know, in another earlier discussion, that you know, we're continuously pushing that rock up the hill, you know, that may or may not look like the head of Zeus or whatever figure we think that we have grievances about, it's always, there's always something that is in that outer shield of oblivion to keep us busy and preoccupied so that we stay out of the mind. But if we look at and turn the tables around and use the GIST acronym, use the individuality, space, and time, use the boulder that we're pushing up the hill, use the outer shield of oblivion, which is anything that involves energy or matter or our bodies or the world, or, you know, certainly the world, the myopic world that we think that we inhabit, which usually is a pretty tiny subset of our neighborhood, let alone the cosmos. But, you know, all the things that we give such importance to, and kind of like the turning the binoculars backwards, we're so focused on just what applies to us. The way we can turn around is through shared interest and expanding our definition of self moment to moment by thinking in terms of, well, who am I thinking about right now, or who am I relating to right now, and how can I be the most helpful to who I'm in communication with? So in this particular instance, I could, you know, use that as an example to think, well, how can I share something that that helps me in the process of just, by the way, possibly helping whoever's listening to this right now. And I think if we can, you know, remember that we're always teaching one of two thought systems at any given moment, we're either teaching the loving kindness of the Holy Spirit's curriculum, or we're teaching the, the sin, guilt, fear paradigm, which sounds, you know, a bit harsh in a sense, but the beauty is that it never happened, and that's what makes us, free. So anyway, so Freud, basically, this article talks about how in the interpretation of dreams, Sigmund Freud, said, the interpretation of dreams is the royal road to a knowledge of the unconscious activities of the mind. And then it continues. This seminal statement is based on the psychoanalytic notion that the activities of the unconscious, the irrational and unbridled impulses of the id, were by definition totally inaccessible to our consciousness and therefore could seemingly never be uncovered and treated. However, such exposure to what the father of psychoanalysis conceived to be our innate drives was essential if people were to be helped with their problems, since Freud posited that it was these unconscious impulses that were the determinants of all that we thought, felt, and believed, not to mention how we behaved. And then it goes on to talk about how, he knew that this was, there was bad news in the unconscious and that we needed to expose it. And his method was to look at nocturnal dreams. Well, the course kind of picks up where Freud left off and extends it further to say, well, if our daytime dreams are equally amenable and suitable subjects for that dream interpretation, not by our individual selves, but by our inner kindness teacher, then that means that we can afford to look at everything. And not beat ourselves up when we have huge lapses in remembering to do so. But we really can use everything that happens to us as a symbolic messenger or a metaphoric symbol to looking at what's going on in our unconscious mind. So if the least little bit of annoyance, irritation, or, all-out warfare from hangnails to Holocaust, we can see that there's, if we can see that there's the least bit of upset, that can be a trigger to say, okay, meet, dashboard indicator light goes on in the mind, and a little red flashing light that says, okay, time to, like so many of the workbook lessons suggest, it says, practice them routinely throughout the day, but particularly whenever you're upset. If you've noticed how the theme of a lot of those workbook lessons goes, try to be mindful through the day and not beat yourself up too much when you forget to do the every hour, every 15 minutes, every however often things, which of course we're all going to forget because we're so busy and we've made other things in the world more important.
So let me ask you something, Bruce, here.
Sure.
What I'm hearing here, and this is kind of a different thing than I have normally been doing, but I'm seeing how perfect it is, that whatever seems to be happening in my life and the world, if I just looked at it as if it were a dream that is not really happening, but is something that I'm just experiencing in my mind, and look for how do I interpret this? Or what does this mean? What is this saying about my thoughts? Because really, it's the whole idea of looking at your thoughts, but it's looking at your thoughts in relation to what appears to be happening, what is seemingly happening in the world. And if
you still there? Oops. Uh-oh. I just lost your audio, Lynn. Are you still there? I'm going to continue talking because I'm not sure if, because I usually have two Skype channels. So if you could check in, I'm going to just type something here. Did we lose one of your Skype connections. Anyway, I'll just continue on and to respond to your comment and question, which is perfect, by the way. Oh, here we go. We're back again. I see you dialing in again on the Skype.
Oh, that is so weird. I clicked off Skype.
Yeah, I noticed that. I wasn't sure if I was still getting through on the recording or on the
no, they're the still room, hearing but, you. So,
yeah. Oh, okay.
So you.
Okay. Well, anyway, yeah.
Go ahead then.
So what I was. Oh, God. Well, yeah, I just was starting to say that you know, that was a great comment and a question, and that you know, we can use everything that seems to happen to us as an opportunity to look, you know, but kind of like taking Freud's psychoanalytic idea, but I don't think we have to drill down and get, you know, super analytical about all the specifics, because that's, I think, oftentimes a way to get distracted and play right into the ego script of, oh, let's just really, you know, complicate the heck out of things. I think it really gets real simple is the more we practice it of, am I at peace or not? It can be kind of a binary question. And if we're not at peace, then we can kind of go back to our three R's, like we talked about last week, of, you know, reveal, release, and replace. We can see where, if we're not at peace, we reveal to ourselves that, you know, we must have chosen badly. Time to resign as my own teacher again. I must have picked up that sword that is the warlike teacher, and I can afford to drop it again, and then release. You know, release the sword, drop it, you know, stop it. As that wonderful skit goes, the Bob Newhart skit. We can just basically just catch ourselves. And it's, the more we do it, the more we can do it kind of almost mid-thought, you know, before we go down that path and get ourselves in deeper trouble. And catch the dream material and say, whoops, hey, I don't want to go there because that doesn't feel good. That's an interpretation that is based on separate interests and the we-they paradigm that keeps me at odds with everyone else and an adversarial relationship, and also with the oneness that I really want, you know, with the Creator. And we're probably not conscious of that level very often, but the more that we practice noticing everything that comes up as the classroom opportunity, and then forgiving ourselves using those three R's and allowing Holy Spirit to replace, which is the third R, then we can use those two shields of oblivion and the dream technique to say, well, okay, anything that's happening out on my theatrical screen of the mind in the space-time dream drama is a suitable subject for just looking at the contents of my mind. And that is what that article points out is such a phenomenally helpful thing, because it gives us that royal road back into the mind and really, as Ken points out, back to the, you know, the heaven, if you will, that of the peace that we never left. So we can use what Freud started to do by realizing, you know, there's something rotten in Denmark, so to speak. There's, you know, the unconscious mind has all this crap in it because, well, we don't want to look at it. And if we want to look at it, if we can shift around to wanting to look at the junk that's there, but not condemning ourselves, you know, when that stuff comes up, we can afford to just gently smile and say, oh yeah, there I go again. I'm afraid of that peace. I'm afraid of that unchangeable love. And that's okay, because it'll be waiting for me when I'm ready for it again. And we can then use that curriculum to get back to the mind. We go through the specifics of the individuality, space-time, the outer shield of oblivion, take whatever seems to be happening to us, you know, as Gary Renard's teachers, you know, whatever comes up in front of our face on a given day as our forgiveness classroom, use that to get back to the mind. And then, of course, that's when ego flips all the red alerts, indicators on our mind's dashboard and says, right, you know, all hands on deck kind of thing. And, you know, puts the missile system on high alert, because it says, okay, we, you know, our egos say, no way, you're not getting to that mind. That's off limits. That's the one thing that we, you know, promised our ego we wouldn't do is go there, you know. And, you know, Toto pulls back the curtain. We see that there's nothing there, but that's only happens when we're willing to, you know, kind of the innocence of Toto metaphorically, or taking the hand of our inner kindness teacher, gives us that vantage point where we, if we do look at it without condemnation, because the condemnation is basically the fear that says, I don't want to pull back that curtain and see what's there. You know, it manifests in a lot of different ways, but it's all with some kind of fear. But if we can not be afraid of that insanity and just look at it dispassionately, which really we can only do above the battleground metaphorically by taking the symbolic hand of our inner kindness teacher, because we're then letting go of that identity that doesn't serve us. And then our real identity, the replacement of the three R's, it just kicks in immediately, because that's what we really are. And that's the self that we all share ultimately, that can look at the insanity of the ego thought system and see that there is nothing to it. But it's only when we come from that perspective, that vantage point above the battleground, that then we can afford to do that. So let me scroll down again to that place where in this article it talks about the inner shield of oblivion. Oblivion. There it is. Oh, I think I searched on the whole site. Let me back up. I think I searched on the whole site. Let me just search on that page. There we go. Okay. Yeah, so I'm going to skip down to a quote from this is actually workbook lesson number 70. And it talks about, Ken says, this constant activity, referring to, you know, the shenanigans of the separate, the split mind, reflects the ego's ongoing attempts to have us believe that our problems and therefore solutions are in the world and not in our minds. There's that outer shield, right? And then this is a quote from workbook number 70, lesson 70. All temptation is nothing more than some form of the basic temptation not to believe the idea for today. And in quotes, my salvation comes from me, meaning the real self. Salvation seems to come from anywhere except from you. And so therefore we're, you know, at the mercy of, you know, the whims of whatever seems to be delivered to us, right? Or arrive at our circumstances. So then lesson continues. So too does the source of guilt. You see neither guilt nor salvation as in your own mind and nowhere else. Well, that's the only place that we can resolve it is in our own mind, because we don't have access to anything else if there really is nothing else. Right? When you realize that all guilt is solely an invention of your mind, you also realize that guilt and salvation must be in the same place. In understanding this, you are saved. That's a pivotal idea, that the release from the torment of all the stuff that seemed to bother us, that seemed to be outside in the world, which is really the unconscious guilt, just in a convenient form that keeps us mindless. That solution, when we bring that darkness of the guilt to the light of salvation, as using this workbook metaphor language here, then voila, it's just like matter and antimatter. Poof, you know, they neutralize and make light. So I think the same kind of process sort of symbolically takes place when we realize that unfounded sin, guilt, fear thought system that's all predicated on a tiny mad idea that separation seemed to be possible and gave rise to that whole thought system, which is in the inner shield of oblivion, and the outer shield being the entire cosmos that we made up. And that's something that modern physics is probably not going to posit anytime soon, that the source of the universe is unconscious guilt. probably not going to read that in physics journals anytime soon. But some of the more progressive physicists, such as John Wheeler, who says, you know, there's no out there, I think are headed in that direction, you know, and you know, so many of the amazing and astonishing revelations that came out of quantum mechanics several decades ago in Copenhagen and subsequent meetings and experiments and so on and so forth, all revolved around the idea that the mind is no longer something that could be swept under the rug. The double slit experiment, which was replicated countless times, showed that the mind of the experimenter is primary in determining what is going to be observed. We actually have to collapse the wave function, as it's called, in order to have something tangible. And then the irony of that is that tangible thing, you can measure the position, but not the velocity or vice versa, those kind of things. I forget the exact terminology, but essentially that's what the uncertainty of this world is that when you get down to the subatomic level, we can't really know what's exactly going on. And I think that's because, what quantum mechanics, the new physics theory tells us is that we're trying to figure out what's going on in the mind by looking at the screen of the theater of our mind. And it wasn't made there. The film wasn't made there. So how are we going to know what the causality is if we're looking in the wrong place? And I think that's kind of fascinating. So anyway, let me finish this prefacing paragraph. The seeming cost of accepting today's idea is this. It means that nothing outside yourself can save you. Well, there's the outer shield of oblivion. Nothing in the world of space, time, individuality, matter, energy, bodies, stuff, other people, other things, the whole realm of our finances, our health, our social structures, our ecology, our governments, or anything that we think of as being important, not to diminish those things and say that we shouldn't do what we can to make them as wonderful as we can, but those things are going to make us happy or bring us peace that's lasting. And so I'll read this again. The seeming cost of accepting today's idea is this. It means that nothing outside yourself can save you. Nothing outside yourself can give you peace. And here's the fun part. It says, but it also means that nothing outside yourself can hurt you or disturb your peace or upset you in any way. Today's idea places you in charge of the universe, where you belong because of what you are. Ta-da! Ain't that sweet? We don't buy that most of the time, but it's nice once in a while to just stop for a moment and pause and reflect on the feeling that I think that drew all of us, and whether it's, takes these words or not, it doesn't matter. But that knowing this, there's got to be something more. There's got to be something that resolves that unconscious angst and grief and longing and wondering and uncertainty. Speaking of physics again, the uncertainty of the world is resolved by the certainty of the real world, which really is itself an illusion too, but it's an illusion that is based on forgiveness that leads to what doesn't change. And I guess that's probably more accurate to say. So anyway, Ken continues after this excerpt from workbook lesson number 70. He says, indeed, because of our having forgotten the true source of our distress, our mind's decision to be separate from God, we have become virtually mindless, the ego's ultimate goal. Bingo, zombies. And when we catch ourselves during the day in our, robotic, zombified state, kind of going about doing things, especially like the workbook lessons suggest, is, when we catch ourselves being upset, not just, forgetting to do the workbook lessons, but actually, distressed or upset with what's happening in the world or in our minds, we can afford to stop, take a deep breath, and say, yeah, there really is a peace that's beyond all this. And, we really can afford to be peaceful in truth, because that has not been compromised, and nor was it ever threatened. it never could be damaged or even encroached upon in any way. So I'm going to read that first sentence over again. Indeed, because of our having forgotten the source of our distress, our mind's decision to be separate, there's that decision-making faculty from God, we have become virtually mindless, the ego's ultimate goal. Therefore, as we stated above, if we are without a mind, there is naturally no way we can ever change our minds about the ego. And, you know, back to Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, who I like to paraphrase with, what would you do with a mind if you had one? Talking to the Scarecrow. She said brain, but I like to replace that with mind. Too. And that's really the question ego does not want us to ask, because if we recognize we have a mind, then we can choose against it. We can say, that maladaptive solution to the non-existent problem isn't working out too well for me. I could choose against that that no and just choose a not no, and which is the Holy Spirit's yes, which is to say, I am as God created me. I'm not a harbor for evil, darkness, and sin. That's just silly. Not evil or wicked. It's just silly. Yeah. So, the plan. Okay, let me back up this. And this seems to ensure that its thought system of separation, individuality, and specialness will remain forever beyond hope of correction. Yeah, that's it. As long as there's no mind, if the locus of control or the place that we have some say in, some jurisdiction over, is outside of us, then, you know, it's hopeless, isn't it? I mean, if there's no way of affecting what happens to us, then, you know, we're in deep trouble. But we don't get to control the script of the dream. We get to control what mechanism we're choosing, one of which is to basically invest in an identity that is a dream figure, and then the other is to invest in, or really de-invest in that, which automatically switches us over to the real all-inclusive identity, which is the dreamer. And once we notice we're dreaming, and we're not that impressed with where the dream is going, we don't have to leave the dream. But we can leave our investment in, you know, the dream figure, right? Were you going to say something, Lynn?
You must be reading my mind. Yes, because it really is just a choice. And if you can just take it on faith, just simply say, okay, the Course Jesus says, this is a dream. I'm going to believe it. I'm going to take it on faith, and I'm going to question everything that happens as if it were a dream.
Uh-huh.
Just like I question things in a dream. How can I be flying? How can I be up on this roof? Where did this thing come from? Why is there a tiger chasing me? You know, these are all the things that seem improbable. If you look around at the world itself and you see the things that seem to be happening, and see how improbable they all are. It's like, how can this be? Mm-hmm. I say that every day, all day. How can this be? And anytime that comes up, it's like, well, it's a dream. And yeah. It's showing me something about my own mind. And so this is right on target. It's, you know, you don't have to, you don't have to believe that it's a dream. You just have to treat it as if it were, and you will see that it is. It becomes very evident. In fact, the evidence becomes stronger and stronger and stronger every day, to where you look around and say, how could I have ever believed this? I look around, I'm like, how could I have ever thought this was true? But it's all in your mind. So.
Yeah, it is. It is. And that questioning, that gentle questioning is really the way out. You know, not to question in the sense of you know, trying to make it real, but questioning, could this possibly be real? And as you were saying that, I couldn't help but laugh and think, I flashed on a little SNL Saturday Night Live skit from years ago, and I was thinking, wow, the profound words of wisdom from that great sage Steve Martin, who said, what is this dang deal? You know, what's going on here? What what could possibly have motivated me? You know, what was I thinking? To quote another lyric from a singer-songwriter named Christine Lavin, you know, what was I thinking? and that questioning can then be a way to look at how silly it is to think that our identity could be invested in, you know, a finite self. But boy, it's convincing. We made incredible special effects and set design and you know, this three-dimensional holographic movie that is so convincing. But it's part of the dream. It's part of the matrix that we just have to choose a different color pill and, or really a different color different teacher that changes the spectrum of our thinking, if you will. And then we get a whole different thought system. So I'm going to finish this last little bit of this paragraph that touches on the double shield again. So thus is the ego's strategy completed and its promise to preserve the son's individuality fulfilled. So that's it. I mean, the idea that we could be individuals is at the heart of the unconscious guilt, because if we think that there's something important that we have to maintain, and that kind of gets into that fifth stage of the development of trust a bit too, because we can practice forgiveness for a while and realize that we feel better, but eventually we're going to need to really clean the slate and go completely home. And again, it has nothing to do with the form, but to return home in our mind. We need to look at our investment in the very individuality that is really the threshold of that guilt. And the way that works is that as long as we think that there's a self that is doing the forgiving or a self that is deciding between A or B, and we think it's a big deal about that self, then there's still more forgiveness work to do. We still need to gently let go. And that's something that takes usually lifetimes, apparently. And so we can afford to be gentle with ourselves and not fight ourselves and not try to, rush through the process and skip over steps. Just, be gently aware that when we're in a state of resistance, doesn't mean we feed fuel to the fire of the resistance, but we can, if we're having an ego, practicing fit or practicing tantrum yoga, so to speak, we can just gently laugh and say, okay, I guess I was afraid of that peacefulness again, and forgive ourselves, and then pick ourselves up again as quickly as we can and move on without making a big deal about it. And that not making it a big deal of when we catch ourselves in those fearful, angry, or whatever negative emotion you care to fill in the blank with, state, then that frees us up to shorten the gap even quicker next time. We build that mental muscle to continue to practice, looking at our projections, reeling them back in, forgiving our decision-making mind and that identity, and pretty soon that identity begins to fade as the real identity that is our shared interest, which is why thinking in terms of sameness and shared interest is so important and so helpful to make it about the other person, as Ken Wapnick says, and just practice being kind, because that's our part of that royal road, isn't it? It gives us an opportunity to take what used to be an irritation or an annoyance and use it as an opportunity to serve our inner kindness teacher's agenda and turn the thing around. So it says, this is the, I'll read this sentence again. This is the ego strategy completed and its promise to preserve the son's individuality fulfilled. This plan of denying our mind's decision to be separate, projecting the forgotten decision onto the body, is summarized in lesson 136, sickness is a defense against the truth. In this important lesson, Jesus uses the phrase, doubly shielded by oblivion, there it is, to describe how our decision to be separate from the truth is protected by the dynamics of denial and projection. And those two words encompass a whole lot, don't they? Denial and projection. Because we deny, again, that's the inner shield. We deny that, that we're part of perfect oneness. Maybe not consciously, but that's essentially what we're doing. That's where the guilt comes from, is from that denial. And so to deny the denial of truth is our way out. But we don't get to that until we look at the projection. And that's where the royal road of our physical dreams, our waking dreams, becomes crucial and important to seeing that, you know, whatever it is, you know, from the tiniest little speck of dust on our desk to you know, a major life-threatening illness to you know, on a global scale, you know, total nuclear, you know, meltdown, or to just one little quirk, you know, the least little thing to the most seemingly, you know, world-shattering thing, and everything in between. All the irritations and annoyances and problems that seem to be insurmountable are our classroom for the forgiveness process in our mind. And we get an opportunity to look at that by, again, using the outer shield of oblivion to get back to the mind, and then again, always with taking the Holy Spirit's hand, a.k.a. the Jesus of the Course, a.k.a. our inner kindness teacher, and then using that to gently look at where we've invested in the sin, guilt, fear paradigm, that, you know, tiny mad idea thought system, and see that we no longer desire that. We no longer want to engage in that masochistic participation, and that frees us up. So it looks like I've got about a minute left, so I just wanted to, in addition to summarizing this and the guilt, individuality, space, time, trigger words that could be helpful of recognizing our ego, just to see that we can use those double shield of oblivion metaphors to notice when we're defending against the truth, and drop those shields. You know? Drop it. So I'm reachable via acimblog.com. I post all these recordings there. And thank you again, Lynn, for all the work that you're doing, for not just me, but for a lot of people, and all the folks on this forum. I know there's a whole bunch that do a lot of great work. And also I want to just quickly mention that there's an extended date for people who are interested in attending the Weekend of Freedom Retreat, which we talked about at length yesterday evening, that's happening in Estes Park, Colorado, which, I have Lynn to thank for notifying me of that. I think we have another couple of weeks still before the rooms that are reserved for that Weekend of Freedom Retreat are released to the public, and that's weekendoffreedomretreat.org or .com. So anyway, thank you all, and I look forward to sharing again. Lynn and I share on Saturday mornings at, was it 7 a.m.? 6 a.m., whatever it is.
9 a.m. Eastern. It's 6
a.m. 9 a.m. Eastern. 6 a.m. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. And we have a lot of fun. So thank you all, and have a great week.
All right. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. And it's been a pleasure to have you here for this mini series. Thank you all for joining us. And I'm going to let go of this mic and turn it over to Regina for the nightly contemplation. Talk to you later, Bruce.
Hello, everyone. First of all, I just want to remind you all that if you appreciate a mini-series guest speaker, you can donate to Awakening Together, and we will give 100% of that donation to the guest speaker. But in order to make sure that we know you're donating for the mini-series, you want to use the mini-series link. So if you go to the Awakening Together website, click on Donate. You'll notice a mini-series link, plus Lynn has just put it in the room. And if you donate to that, we'll give it directly to the current mini-series teacher. Tonight was Bruce's last night. And so if you were listening to his mini-series and you enjoyed his mini-series and you want to donate, please do that within the next couple of days.